Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
With all due apologies to Britney Spears, oops, they did it again. France gets an S&P downgrade today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at progressive.com. And by the Batten Institute at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, transforming society through entrepreneurship and innovation. BattenInstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 13th of January. Good to have you with us. And bang, just like that, Europe's back in the headlines. Although, to be fair, it's not like S&P downgrading French debt from AAA to AA is even remotely surprising. The hints have been coming for months. The French finance minister confirmed it today, but the question is, what does it mean? So that's where we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street. And beyond for that, we've got Lee Gallagher with us from Fortune Magazine, also Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lee, what does it mean? I mean, you know, the S&P downgraded us, and so what?
Well, it means a lot more when we're talking about Europe because the crisis is just so much bigger and it's not going anywhere. And as you said, I mean, we've known that for months. In December, S&P actually put all these countries on warning. So, you know, we've really been on guard for this. But even so, this today did really have the feel of a Black Friday. And even though it doesn't really change things, anything on a, tangibly, it does make it, you know, it raises borrowing costs for these countries, which is at the crux of what's wrong.
Right.
And it also, you know, investors, traders are already stopping buying some of these countries' bonds, which is just terrible.
Okay, so Cardiff, if that's the case, right? If this is a much worse thing for them than it was for us, why didn't Wall Street go haywire today?
Look, I don't think it went haywire for a number of reasons, but the one thing is that I don't think Wall Street was that shocked by it. We had some sense that it was coming. I also don't know that the impact is going to be so bad. It is only one credit rating agency. It might complicate things a little further because France is one of the countries that also guarantees the European bailout facility. So it's just one more thing. But I would actually argue that the big events happening in Europe right now are all these debt auctions because we don't know to what extent investors will keep buying this debt. This also does put a wrench in that. And if I can just sort of turn away from this for a second,
sure,
keep in mind also that another big thing that happened today.
Whatever you want.
Well, no, it's just that the other big story today that people were paying attention a little bit less to was that talks broke down between the Greek government and bond investors. So we're looking increasingly at the possibility that there's going to be a Greek default. Yet again, we've been here before. But I think to the extent that markets are going to flip out next week, it would be because of something like that rather than this.
All right. Well, let me bring it back to us here for a second, Lee, and ask you about J.P. Morgan. They had troubling profits today. Jamie Dimon said you could put him in the increasingly worried about Europe camp. I mean, it does sort of seem to be getting going again.
That's true, but I think most of J.P. Morgan's problems, and in fact, all of the banks are facing these headwinds. They're really facing the same set of headwinds, which are, you know, changes to their fee structure because of regulation, a severe drop in trading revenue, little deal-making business. I mean, so much of the mechanics of the banking system for the U.S. banks, that's where the headwinds are. Less so even than Europe, I would say. I mean, I think he's saying he's more worried about Europe now than he was a month ago, which is totally legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the banks have problems here at home, even as we are seeing a domestic recovery, which he also mentioned. So.
Well, yeah, so let me actually pick up on that, because we're going to hear from a guy by the name of Don Holshue in the next segment of the broadcast, a trucker out in Iowa, about that domestic recovery. But Cardiff, do you actually think there is a domestic recovery, or is it just in the indicators and not in the real economy?
Look, I just don't think we know yet. I think it's too early. People got way too optimistic as all these economic indicators started coming up in December. I think a lot of that was seasonal stuff that wasn't captured by the data. And in terms of what J.P. Morgan said about it, well, there was some good news. There was also some bad news. So, yeah, it looks like some people are taking out more loans and things like that. On the other hand, their mortgage businesses remain really bad. I mean, delinquencies are still high. Foreclosures are still high. There's still losses there. As Lee mentioned, the investment banking side, I mean, you know, the results there were atrocious. So I really think it's too early to tell. I think people got a little bit out in front of themselves. And we're going to find out more in the next few months whether or not what happened in November and December was real or whether it was another false start like it was last year.
Lee, quickly, your sense, real or false start?
I think it's a very slow real start. I think after 3 years, we're fine. There was tons of false optimism. There were tons of false starts. But I think that we are at the beginning of repairing ourselves, but it's very, very, very slowly.
All right. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Have a good weekend. It wasn't just France that lost a little bit to S&P either, by the way. It was Austria, Italy, and Spain as well. The markets reacted accordingly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So as I was saying to Lee in Cardiff, last summer I talked to a guy named Don Holshue. He's a truck driver out in the Midwest. He's 56 years old, and he delivers to hardware stores all up and down Iowa and Minnesota. And we had him on to get a sense of the actual economy, the one that has nothing at all to do with presidential campaigns or congressional debates. And we figured it'd be a good idea to check in again as the new year starts. So we got him on the phone. Mr. Holshue, good to have you back.
Well, it's nice that you called.
Where do we track you down?
Right now I'm in Floyd, Iowa, which is west of Mason City, Iowa.
Right.
The beautiful highway of 218.
218. What's in the back of your truck today?
Nothing. I just got done unloading this morning in Wellman, Iowa, and the last hardware store, and I'm heading home.
Heading home. All right. Very good. Listen, I want to play a piece of tape from the last time we spoke back in August, and I want to get your thoughts on that. So here we go. Let's hit that tape.
The first time in my life that I'm cutting back, and it doesn't make any difference. It's frustrating where everything has gone up and seems to go up all the time. And I have a budget. And beforehand, 3 years ago, I was able to make it, no problem. But now I'm one nostril above the water.
Still the same way for you?
Well, I've cut back. I've bundled a lot of services. And I've actually kind of steadied out. It's still not, not prime, but we're making do. We just have to make adjustments.
Do you have more room to cut? I mean, if you had to, do you have more room?
No, it's it.
You know, I brought this up last time we spoke and you laughed at me actually when you answered, but, there are actually signs the economy is getting better. Are you seeing any of that where you are?
No, I mean, it's flat. It's not like a full recovery. You don't see a full recovery going on. The unemployment figures, I don't know. I don't, and everybody else that I talk to, they don't believe it. I've got four or five friends that are unemployed still, and three or four are working part-time at a job that they can barely even get by.
You sound a little more resigned to things just staying flat than when we spoke last time.
I'm sorry. It's just, I just don't see anything in the horizon. Maybe it's just because the recession's lasted so long, but people don't really have an outlook for the future very well, especially people like over 50, like myself, looking, I'm going to have to work until whatever, it's wearing on people. Let's put it, the mood is it's getting along.
Don Holshue, by the side of the road in Floyd, Iowa. Mr. Holshue, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Drive carefully. There are few things in business as worthless as an empty seat once an airliner takes off. And there are few things in business as vulnerable as a bankrupt company. Put those two things together and you've got the source of all the speculation this week that American Airlines is ripe for a takeover. There have been suggestions that U.S. Airways might be interested in buying American out of Chapter 11. And today came the possibility that Delta, the world's second biggest carrier, might want in as well. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon tried to figure out what happens if that happens.
There's no question Delta and American would make a powerful combination.
The merger would create the world's largest airline.
Roger King follows the industry for credit sites. He sees an upside, a carrier that would have excellent coverage in almost every part of the world and hubs in big cities all over the country. King says that would make life easier for most travelers. But wouldn't the merger also reduce competition and drive up prices? He argues there's probably less chance of that happening than in other businesses.
The domestic market share of a merger, I think, would be approximately 35%. Doesn't sound very high when you compare it to Pepsi and Coke.
Aviation consultant Michael Boyd says the whole point of the recent consolidations has been to make the industry stronger.
The merger, like between Delta and Northwest, did not give anybody any less choice, and it didn't cause fares to go up. I don't know if this one would cause fares to go up either, because, look, we don't have a really competitive industry now anyway.
A Delta-American merger could face bigger hurdles overseas. Industry consultant Bob Mann says American would be absorbed into Delta's SkyTeam partnership with foreign airlines, effectively killing the oneworld group that American now leads.
It would mean that carriers who are largely dependent on those alliances for their operations, for example, British Airways and Iberia, would suddenly find themselves without a partner.
Mann suggests Delta might just be trying to raise the stakes and the price for some other suitor for American. Consultant Michael Boyd considers a Delta-American merger unlikely, and even if it happens, he doubts it would bring any dramatic changes.
I think the real winner would be Sherwin-Williams selling paint to the airline to repaint airplanes.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Coming up in Paris, France, dancing to music only you can hear.
I've been spending my whole summer with all these silent events. I love it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Now industrials fell 0.4%. Today, 48 points ended things at 12,422. The NASDAQ down 0.5%, 14 points, 2710. The S&P 500 dropped 0.5%. That is 6 points on that particular index. Finished at 1289. Overall, though, not a bad week. The Dow packed on 0.5%. The NASDAQ climbed 1.4%. The S&P 500 up 0.9%. Financials suffered all the way around. Morgan Stanley dropped 3.1%. Citigroup gave back 2.75%. Bank of America off 2.75%. J.P. Morgan Chase, as we were talking about earlier, withdrew 2.5%. After a great week, snapping up more than a 100% rise, rumors of Eastman Kodak's long-awaited bankruptcy caught up with the camera and film company. Today, shares went negative, down 23%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. Events in Washington and around the country mark Martin Luther King Jr. Day. U.S. stock markets are closed because of the holiday. And hey, tennis fans, get ready to make some racket. The first Grand Slam of the season gets underway, the Australian Open. G'day, I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The NCAA has been meeting this week in Indianapolis, and as tends to happen at annual conventions, there's a good amount of bylaw rewriting going on at the organization. But two proposed new rules in particular are proving especially contentious. One of them would require athletic scholarships be granted for more than just 1 year at a time, as they are now. The other would offer $2,000 stipends to student-athletes, in addition to room, board, and tuition, in effect, paying them to play. That proposed stipend is not universally popular among college presidents. More than 100 of them have formally objected, including Bob Kustra. He's the president of Boise State University. Mr. Kustra, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Why are you opposed to these recommendations?
Well, Kai, I think we have to start with the proposition of just what does a full scholarship athlete get today. It's really a great program. One Southeast Conference school actually estimated how many dollars are behind one of their basketball players, and they came up with $300,000. So we're not talking about just tuition and textbooks here. The scholarship athlete on any Division I campus is really a privileged person by virtue of having weight and conditioning coaching available, a training table, and academic support, including individual tutoring. Now, not all Division I programs are created equal, but my point is that this extra $2,000 is really what takes you over a threshold from being an amateur athlete to being a professional athlete.
Okay, wait a second. I mean, with all respect, $2,000 takes it from being an amateur athlete to a professional athlete when the revenues that schools get from these athletes is in the millions and millions of dollars. I mean, that doesn't seem quite to jive.
Well, I say it crosses the threshold because once it's 2,000, Kai, I don't know where you stop. I think that from there, then you open up the fact, you realize the fact that you're now paying students to play. And once you pay students to play, why does it have to stay at $2,000?
But it does seem, though, that in the face of college athletics the way it is today, big-time college sports, by which obviously we do mean men's basketball and football mostly, the term student-athlete has become an oxymoron. And these kids are revenue generators and while not technically, certainly de facto employees of this school and bringing in immense amounts of money.
Well, I cannot disagree with that. But what I would say to the NCAA and Mark Emmert in that case is, why don't you call this what it is? Why don't you open up the whole discussion? Why don't we take a look at Division I football and men's basketball and really ask ourselves how you can continue justifying these sports as amateur athletics? And if you want to do something about that, then come up with a complete and entire plan. Don't nitpick your way through it by adding a $2,000 increase here and a $2,000 increase later and wherever it's going to go. You've crossed the threshold to professionalism of the student athletes. So let's go there. Let's talk about it. I don't think the NCAA, in a sense, I think the NCAA wants to have it both ways. I think it wants to deal with the margins, but I don't think it wants to deal with the really big question that you just asked. And I cannot deny that there is a problem out there when it comes to football and men's basketball. The hundreds of millions of dollars is changing hands among coaches, media companies, universities. Why not take another look?
I want to make sure I understand you here, Mr. Kustra. You want to have this discussion. You want to talk about this.
I think the NCAA should talk about it in a larger fashion than just taking the $2,000 issue and dealing with that. Open it up. Let's discuss it. Some people may decide we want to go there. Others may decide we won't want to go there. But my only point is, what are you going to turn the whole system upside down for two sports that have gotten, you might say, out of hand?
Out of hand. Bob Kustra is the president of Boise State University in Idaho. Mr. Kustra, thanks so much for your time.
Kai, it's nice to be with you. Appreciate you having me.
It's been just over 50 years since Newton Minow, he was the head of the FCC at the time, called commercial television a vast wasteland. And depending on what you watch, he wasn't all that wrong. We've been looking at the future of TV this week. And yes, there is a future. More channels, more to watch, more gadgets to watch on, more of everything. And that, says commentator Rob Long, could prove scary for those in the business of TV.
We tend to think of televisions as those big things that hang on the wall with plugs and cords that we don't really understand. In the last decade, televisions like that have gotten huge and flat and complicated, but they've also gotten tiny and simple. The smartphone you're probably carrying in your pocket is a television, so is an iPad. And we all know that if you're under 30, say, you probably don't even own one of those big flat things. Your television is your laptop. all of which means that the cozy, lucrative television business in which a few dozen folks with important eyewear and expensive shoes told you what you're going to be watching and when and on which device, well, those days are gone. The future of television belongs to upstarts and disruptors like Netflix, the online movie streaming service now launching its own slate of scripted programming, or YouTube, which is about to launch a series of professionally produced channels of television, backed by the limitless resources of Google, or even Twitter. I mean, it's just a matter of time before a big brand, say, like Doritos, decides to launch its own programming. Or better yet, maybe it will just take a portion of its giant promotional budget and buy a show that's already on. Tosh.0, say, which is Comedy Central's biggest hit, or resurrect a cult favorite, as Netflix is considering doing with the late, great Arrested Development. In other words, it's impossible not to be excited about the future of television. Unless, of course, you're one of those people with expensive shoes and important eyewear. The current environment is the worst possible outcome for those people. See, there's only one way to compete against the television upstarts. You have to put on good shows. All of them have to be good. And you have to make money on them, too, because you're selling that show specifically. That agonizing cry you hear from the folks in the television business comes as we all try to learn how to make money in the most painful, least attractive way. We have to earn it.
Rob Long is a television writer and producer.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Our letters segment today starts where Rob Long just left off, the business of the future of television. I talked to Janice Suter yesterday about how advertisers can reach an increasingly digital younger generation. Andrew DeLong of Moores Forks, New York, wrote in to say, hey, look, we're more clever than you think we are.
We're able to attach certain free programs to our browsers that block the advertisements, but not the content. We also have this ability for tablets and smartphones. Basically, if advertisers want to get to my demographic, they really need to up their game, even more so than what they think is working now.
We had David Novak, the CEO of Yum Brands, on the program this week. Yum owns Kentucky Fried Chicken, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, as you may know. It's a global trifecta of fast food, we called it. Liz Hoffman from Fairfield, Connecticut, calls it something else.
For me, the more relevant and pressing title should have been Yum Brands, a global trifecta of poor health. It's the prevalence of those restaurants that help to cause obesity, heart disease, and illness. With almost 34% of all U.S. adults obese, it's not a laughing matter.
Finally, author William Poundstone and his book, Are You Smart Enough to Work at Google? After he had me answer hypothetical questions from Google's notoriously difficult job interviews, he helped us write some of our own, like this one. Find the quickest path from the roof of one building to another. Kyle Bozeman from Troy, Alabama, gave it a shot.
I'd construct a very large slingshot out of available materials on the roof. Then I would estimate the draw length required to move 500 feet without going too high or too low very carefully.
Oh, yeah. No, what could possibly go wrong? You can find our pretend job interview questions on our website. And while you're there, send us your thoughts as well. It's marketplace.org. Depending on where you live, the noisy weekend party is a hazard that you just get used to. But in really crowded cities, blasting loud music gets old before you get used to it. And in Paris, it's practically impossible to play music at danceable volumes without upsetting a large number of people. And that is one reason the French capital is turning into the silent disco capital of the world, as John Lawrenson explains.
It's past midnight, and a room full of young Parisians are jumping up and getting down to music in their headphones. If you slip off your cans, it sounds like this.
Jump around! Jump up, jump up, get down!
The party's in an 18th century monument called La Rotonde. The windows are open, and people are also dancing on the balcony. Among them, Justine Davaux.
I think it's great. It brings a big atmosphere. I've been spending my whole summer with all these silent events around Paris in parks, etc. And doing a party in a park is amazing, completely amazing. So I love it.
Or by the river, or under the Eiffel Tower, even in your own home. Born in Amsterdam and developed in London, silent discos have found a home in what some claim is Europe's most party-averse city, Paris. A town where police enforce a no-noise curfew after 10 p.m. A town where nightlife means walking the dog. Bertrand Riguidel, with a company called Silent Events, says they're organising private parties every weekend for people who want to be able to party without poisoning relations with their neighbours.
If you want to organise your birthday, you ask us to come in your house and you take all the headphones you need, and it costs €5 by headphones. So very simple.
Commercially simple it is, but Parisians are giving it some surprising applications. We're on the median of a busy boulevard in Paris's Pigalle red light district. Buses disgorge crowds of tourists from Germany, Poland and China. I'm surrounded by people wearing headphones, looking across the road at a paraphernalia superstore called Sexodrome. Up in the second floor shop window, the singer-songwriter Giedre is giving her second silent gig. Giedre's first silent concert was at a restaurant and silent disco club called Les Parisiennes, and that was kind of special too.
Actually, I played in the ladies' room. Yeah, and because I was really sick at that moment, and you know, and I put a TV on the stage, and somebody was filming in the restroom, and it was like live on the TV. People were in the restaurant with the headphones, and so it was quite funny.
Giedre says she likes silent gigs because they mix up the live event with the private, intimate way many people listen to music now on their MP3 players. And she says, in an increasingly noise-intolerant world, it's a way of fighting for the right to party, but in a non-confrontational way. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today from the campaign trail. We've been talking a bit about super PACs this week, political groups that can spend basically unlimited amounts to support the candidates of their choice. Newt Gingrich is telling his super PAC to back off, Winning Our Future, it's called, and they're the ones that released that anti-Romney video yesterday, taking Romney to task for his time at Bain Capital. Anyway, this morning, King of Bain, as the video is known, got a 4 Pinocchio truthfulness rating from the Washington Post. 4 Pinocchio, you get it? The nose? Truthful? Anyway, all right. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 0.4%, 48 points, ended things at 12,421. The NASDAQ off 0.5%, 14 points, 2710. The S&P 500 dropped 0.5%, 6 points, finished at 1289. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a show on the Oprah Network, a new debit card as well. Wouldn't you say that Susie Orman has enough on her hands?
In 3 years, I'll be 63, almost 64. And so at that point in time, I want to go around the world on a boat that I helped captain.
All righty. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here Monday afternoon. Have a good weekend. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.